You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last week, the Rent Guidelines Board froze rents for the first time in 46 years, the first time in its history. At the other end of the housing spectrum, one of the world's most expensive apartments has been proposed in Central Park South. It would cost $250 million. Like the weather, everybody complains about New York City real estate, but nobody does anything about it except those aiming to make a profit, and that may require getting tenants to move out. It's become a growth industry. D.W. Gibson related the stories of residents in gentrifying neighborhoods in his book, The Edge Becomes the Center, and in an article in The Nation called How to Dump Tenants and Make a Fortune. He reports on how some New York City landlords are turning affordable housing into luxury apartments. I'm very pleased that it's brought D.W. Gibson to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Have you been following how landlords are responding to the rent freeze on stabilized apartments?
Generally not happy with it, and promises that it's going to further diminish services for tenants, although I don't know how we could further diminish services.
But doesn't that mean the landlords would just try to make up the difference on non-stabilized units?
Try to increase the amount of rent-stabilized units that they bring to market value as well.
The city says there are just over 1 million rent-stabilized apartments. How rapidly are rent-regulated apartments being released from regulation?
Well, in the last 4 years, we've lost about 34,000, I believe. Consider that the mayor has a goal of building 200,000 new affordable units in 10 years. But the way the laws are organized now and the way that landlords can circumvent them, we stand to lose 250,000 much sooner than that. So there's a net loss.
The city first declared a housing emergency in 1974. Do we know what the current state of New York City's rental market is like?
It's certainly a crisis. You have not only in terms of vacancy rates, but in terms of affordability. So you have a lack of housing stock, and the stock that is out there is out of reach for a lot of New Yorkers.
Rent controls were originally imposed across the United States during World War II, but after the war, only one city maintained them, and that was New York. What makes New York City different?
I mean, I think this is one way that New York City has the potential to really lead thinking across the nation, and we are unique in that we have rent stabilization laws. What makes it different? I think it's size and its complexity. We're forever growing. We have been now for decades. And not only the number of people here, but the types of people here, new immigrants, people working in different fields at different income levels.
Hasn't rent regulation been proposed in other parts of the country, Los Angeles and places like that?
Sure, but it's an uphill battle to make it happen. I mean, it's very hard to unify tenants to be the political force that the real estate industry can be in very short order.
Rents increased roughly 23% between 2013 and 2014 in Crown Heights and Borough Hill and Brooklyn. At that rate, rents would almost double in 3 years.
Exactly. And I think the most important fact to run alongside that one is look at wages, you know, because we pay rent with the wages we earn. So what are wages doing? And they're not rising in a commensurate fashion.
It used to be 1 week's wages would be a month's rent. That was the common accepted rate. That's no longer the case.
Yeah. So, landlords want to see that you have 40 times, you're basically putting 40% of your income towards your rent. And consider someone working for $8.75 an hour, minimum wage after taxes, they're bringing home about $15,000, $16,000 a year. So it's just that equals an apartment about $380 a month, which doesn't really exist in New York City.
What's driving prices in the city's housing? The population hasn't grown all that much, has it?
It has grown, but that's not necessarily what's driving it. What's driving pricing in New York City is the flow of global capital. So you have fewer rental units, more condos. You have people coming and getting involved in New York City real estate, not as quote-unquote end users, that is people looking for homes, but rather people looking to make an investment, a place to park their money.
Why didn't the burst of the housing bubble affect New York the way it affected the rest of the country?
New York works so differently in terms of housing when judged against the rest of the city. one way is this flow of global capital. You know, we have to remember we had a lot of Europeans buying New York City apartments in 2006, 2007 because the euro was so strong. So even in that sense, we were positioned very differently than the rest of the country. And the familiar narrative with family being foreclosed on their house, that was much more the activity in suburbs.
There's been a flow of capital into London and some other major European cities. Are they experiencing something similar?
I think New York is so much of it has already played out in London. In New York, we have still these neighborhoods, particularly in the outer boroughs and particularly in Brooklyn, where there's still this room for growth in terms of zoning and in terms of housing stock that can be turned over to market rate. So there's more room for this to be happening right now in New York.
The city has renewed its declaration of housing emergency every 3 years since 1974. Has anything seriously been done during all that time to address the problem?
I think that there are genuine efforts on the part of some political leadership, but there's nothing that can seriously combat that flow of global capital. There's nothing out there now.
And how is the war between Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo affecting all of this?
It's not helping it. And certainly de Blasio, to his credit, was asking for a lot of things that would have been very helpful. I know Alicia Glynn was asking, the deputy mayor of Housing and Economic Development, she was asking for this cap at which apartments can be moved from the rent stabilized program to the market rates, $2,500. It was raised to $2,700. She was asking to do away with that altogether. She you know, spoke publicly about that being a good idea. That was clearly not a realistic possibility in Albany.
My guest is D.W. Gibson. We're talking about an article he wrote for The Nation called How to Dump Tenants and Make a Fortune. For several years, the tool of choice for housing has been inclusionary zoning, requiring private developers to incorporate low-income units in their new developments. Do you know how well that's been working?
Not so well, because, you know, on a couple of fronts. One, there are all kinds of exemptions where you can still get tax breaks and public money for building in the outer boroughs where you don't actually have to incorporate the lower income units. But even if one does include low income units, how we define low income, how we define affordability needs to be looked at. There are different ways you can do that depending on the development, but it's generally a little bit more than $30,000.
Samuel Stein of John Jay College says that from 2005 to 2013, only 1.7% of housing growth was affordable. And that's not enough to even match population growth in the city. Now, hasn't the city just ruled that separate entrances in some of these buildings for the wealthier and poorer tenants won't be allowed anymore?
That is, in fact, the case, yeah. And it was disappointing to see that practice continue with some of the developments that had begun under Bloomberg and finished their approval process through de Blasio. We're able to continue that 40 Riverside Drive and some others, yeah.
And the reason is simply a class thing?
Well, you know, I mean, there's...
We don't want to mix the poor people with the wealthy people?
I think that's the effect that ends up having. I think developers will give you a host of reasons in terms of the separate interest is a suite of amenities they offer to their market rate tenants. But in the end, the effect is class division.
Residents in some areas have resisted inclusionary zoning because they see it as a tool for gentrification. And in your book, The Edge Becomes a Center, you referred to gentrification as violence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's this thing that plays out very slowly. And I, you know, say it's not like a bullet or a blade. It's more like the slow encroachment of carbon monoxide, you know, entering one building after another. And that in large part has to do with the loss of existing rent-stabilized units. Again, we tend to focus on new development, but we're losing the stock that we have.
Don't plenty of long-time residents welcome some gentrification?
Long-term residents welcome amenities coming to their neighborhood, and their neighborhood's improving. The problem is gentrification so often doesn't allow for those people to remain a part of that change. So I live in a neighborhood for 20 or 30 years that has been underserved in terms of amenities and groceries and hardware stores. And when those things start to come to the neighborhood, I can't afford the rents, or if I'm a homeowner, I can't afford the new tax bracket.
We're seeing that all throughout the city. in Harlem, the South Bronx, in parts of Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, Bushwick, parts of Queens as well. I don't know about Staten Island. But that has led to all sorts of tension, and at the same time, it has led to a kind of a wonderful resurgence in some of those areas.
Yeah, again, I mean, I spoke to so many New Yorkers, and so few of them talked about not wanting more amenities in their neighborhood. So absolutely, when you can improve the quality of the streetscape as you walk it, the quality of the building that you live in, these are good things. The problem is displacement. The problem is the people that have propped up the neighborhood for decades and are forced out.
Gentrification can make housing unaffordable for many, as you point out. The city's definition of affordable targets household with incomes of about $62,000. Well, the average New York City family makes less than $51,000.
Exactly. So this conversation about gentrification very quickly backs up into a conversation about labor. And, you know, I just can't help but thinking that Los Angeles, if New York knows what's good for it, Los Angeles has just shamed us into a higher minimum wage to $15 an hour as a municipal plan there is something that we could learn from.
You're right. The urgent question is, how do you get around rent regulations? Are there loopholes that allow developers or landlords to dodge the spirit of the law?
Maybe not so much dodge, but let's say massage them to get to where they want to. And there's a whole cottage industry of real estate professionals. Their job is to learn the rent regulation laws so that they can be used to deregulate rent-stabilized apartments.
After you're going to be working with WNYC as a partner on a multi-platform project looking in depth at issues of race, real estate, and gentrification in Brooklyn. How important is race in all of these things we're discussing? Gentrification sometimes means moving people of color out of an area and moving white people into an area.
It does often. I mean, at its core, very technically speaking, it's a class issue. But we can't look at that fact in a bubble. We have to look at it in historic context. And in America, class issues are inextricable from race issues, particularly in urban environments where we have legacies from policies like redlining, where minorities have been targeted and to be put into less desirable parts of the city historically. So absolutely, it's a race issue.
And one lawyer, Simon Moule, is it, said landlords know that if they, by good fortune or malfeasance, get rid of low-paying tenants and put in high-paying tenants, they're going to make more money. What's the good fortune way to get rid of a low-paying tenant?
Knowing the rules. For Simon's part there, he's someone who has made a profession out of learning the rent stabilization laws and coaching investors on how to use those laws to bring their rental units up to market value. So the good fortune in that case is meeting Mr. Moule.
There, one of the ways is to offer tenants a buyout, but Celia Weaver of the Urban Homesteading Assistance Board says a buyout is never a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, this is the legal way to get a rent-stabilized tenant out of one of those units. Landlord knocks on the door and says, I'll give you $5,000 to leave, or I'll give you $50,000 to leave, I'll give you $100,000 to leave, whatever they want to offer. The problem is, and a lot of tenants take those offers because if you've never seen $30,000, it seems like a lot of money. But New York City real estate is climbing exponentially across the board en masse. So if you have that pile of money, it's not as though it's going to help you restabilize your life in another unit within the city. You're very often forced to leave the city altogether.
What happens when tenants refuse a buyout offer?
Landlords then get more aggressive, and they go to other means of trying to get that tenant out of the apartment. And some of those are pretty appalling, and they include going into the apartment under the pretense of wanting to do renovation, taking a sledgehammer, breaking up sinks and running water and toilets so that the tenant then will call 311 and say, my apartment is my landlord showed up. He said he was going to come back to fix things. He didn't. And I don't know what to do. 311 sends out a city representative that looks at the apartment, says, this is unsafe. You have to leave immediately. And then the landlord achieves their end goal of getting the tenant out of the apartment.
And it isn't seen as an illegal act on the part of the landlord?
It is. And there are actually, it's you know, good to know that there has been a high-profile case with Israel Brothers that they were arrested. That said, it's very hard to prove the intent. And so this is something that I've seen across the board happening at an alarming rate, but not being investigated.
One tenant, Noella Calero, spent 2 years in court.
Exactly. Yeah, she was the individual I spoke of at 98 Linden Avenue, and that was a high-profile case, and her landlords did, in fact, go to prison. But
she had 2 years without an apartment?
Exactly. So you know, you can say, well, it's good that the Israel Brothers went to prison, but why did it take 2 years for that to happen?
I'm talking with D.W. Gibson, who is the author of the book The Edge Becomes the Center. We're talking about an article that he wrote for The Nation, How to Dump Tenants and Make a Fortune. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with D.W. Gibson, who's written an article called How to Dump Tenants and Make a Fortune for The Nation magazine. He's also the author of The Edge Becomes a Center, which is about gentrification. You mentioned aggressive methods that landlords are taking. How many of them are legal?
Most of them are not legal. A buyout is really the only legal option. There are instruments they can use. So if you vacate apartment, if you can get a tenant out of the apartment and get a new one in, you can increase the rent by 20%. Vacating an apartment is always good for a landlord because it affords them all kinds of tools to get the rent up.
You describe a rule that allows a fast track out of rent regulation, a preferential rate?
Yeah, so this is a bit complicated but highly interesting because a landlord can set two rents on a lease. One is the registered rent that is registered with the state, and that is what we might call the rent that the landlord aspires to. When the gentrification reaches the neighborhood and they can get market value, let's call it $3,000. They can also put another preferential rate on the lease, and that's what they actually charge the tenant. And it can be much lower. It can be $800 or $900. And at first glance, on the tenant's point of view, this sounds great. Wow, I've got a nice, benevolent landlord who's going to give me a reduced rent. The problem is, the landlord reserves the right at any juncture when they feel like they can get that $3,000, that registered rent, to go to that rate as long as it's been registered with the state.
And you've already agreed to it.
And you have already agreed to it because it's on the lease, yes.
A listener wonders if people understand that the rent freeze only applies to leases of 1 year.
Right, and then there's a increase on leases of 2 years. I think that a lot of leases are 1 year leases, and I think the rent freeze I think is the biggest ray of light in this whole sort of mess that's gone down in Albany and in the city over the last several weeks, because the Rent Guidelines Board has in fact never done a rent freeze. So I think it's a good big step in the right direction.
A listener asks if most people even realize that they're in a rent-controlled apartment. He said that there are all these resources at the HRC and landlords almost don't want you to know about them.
Exactly, yeah. And it is important, I think, too, to differentiate between rent-controlled, rent-stabilized. Rent-controlled are obviously very few of those left. Those are fixed rent rates. But rent-stabilized, where the Rent Guidelines Board decides how much the rent can be increased each year and measures that, those are more common. That's what we have nearly a million of. And absolutely, it behooves the landlord to keep information away from the tenant.
And then another listener wonders about the quality of building materials in many of the renovations or the new buildings. He points out that he was looking at a lot of renovated apartments in Crown Heights that were already looking shabby and run down. Are landlords just doing cheap renovations to make a quick buck?
There are a lot of questionable construction practices. One just has to walk throughout the neighborhood of Brooklyn to see plenty of activity going on without posted notices. And with regards to new construction, I think there are a lot of strong arguments that some architects I've talked to have expressed concern about the materials being used and the sustainability of the buildings.
Legal counsel is usually expensive. When lower-income or even middle-income tenants need a lawyer, what options do they have?
Very few. So Shaker Krishnan at Brooklyn Legal Services, they provide tenant representation, he estimates that they can help about 15% of the people that come to them for help in Brooklyn. You know, if you go to housing court on Livingston Street in Brooklyn and you take the elevator up to the 10th floor and you survey the scene in front of you, you're going to see groups of three people or four people huddled together trying to negotiate a settlement on a case. And those three or four people, it's always a landlord and a tenant, very often a landlord's lawyer, and rarely, rarely a tenant's lawyer. Tenants are so underrepresented. About, again, Krishnan and Brooklyn Legal Services estimates that about 10% of tenants in household court in Brooklyn have representation.
Can't they call the DHCR?
They can, but the resources are so very limited. I mean, the federal funds for legal aid have been reduced steadily over the last decade. The de Blasio administration has put in more resources, but it's not nearly enough to fill the gap. And they do have a long-term plan to put in about $36 million more, but that hasn't yet been fulfilled.
Can landlords draw out legal proceedings to outlast tenants?
Yeah, so that's, you know, the war of attrition. This is one of the tools that a lot of landlords employ, just wear the tenants down. I met a guy in Crown Heights who had been taken to court because he had installed four kitchen cabinets because the others had crumbled. And the landlord took him to court for installing those cabinets.
For improving the apartment.
Yes, absolutely. With permission and funds from the previous landlord. So there are so many cases
Don't those cases just get thrown out? A judge looking at it says that's illogical.
It keeps going. It keeps going. Another court date. And these things get drawn out over months and sometimes years. And many tenants are worn down by them and give up.
I'm talking with D.W. Gibson, whose article, How to Dump Tenants and Make a Fortune, is in The Nation. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. We've been saying terrible things about landlords, but there are good landlords out there, and some argue that they're struggling. What are some of the reasons that they cite?
Absolutely. There's some wonderful landlords out there. You know, the landlord who owns a building, one building or two buildings, where most of the units are rent stabilized, I would argue that they are, in fact, having a hard time making ends meet between the taxes they pay and the insurance and the utilities they provide. It can be difficult. And so those landlords are put into a position where the only real viable option for them is to either A, try to force their rent stabilized units and those tenants out of those units so they can bring them up to market rates, or sell the building so somebody else will do the same thing.
Or renovate,
which they can then, that's how they can bring it up to market rate. They can assign a portion of the cost to renovate those units onto the next tenants. And then once they get to $2,700 a month, then they're free to charge whatever they want to charge.
And landlords are free to self-certify those renovations?
So there has been a little bit of cracking down on this, but yes, they self-certify and they present budgets for how much they spend on the renovations. And I've seen some of the budgets that have been presented. And I mean, I have to tell you, we're not even talking Excel spreadsheet here. We're talking, you know, Word table with very little documentation in terms of line items. And they can represent the budget as they want to.
After the Rent Guidelines Board announced the freeze, Joseph Strasberg, the president of Rent Stabilization Association, a landlord group, called the freeze unconscionable and politically driven, and said that landlords, I'm quoting, will now have to forego repairing, maintaining, and preserving their apartments. How does the city or anybody else monitor what landlords do to maintain the apartments?
It's a good question, and a new task force has been set up in concert with Eric Schneiderman's office and de Blasio's office. And so I'm eager to see how they're going to enforce or let's say go after malevolent landlord behavior. But heretofore, there haven't been many instruments for going after landlords that have harassed their tenants or not provided the services they need to provide.
According to the Rent Guidelines Board, construction in the city peaked in 1927. That's 90 years ago. Over 107,000 new units were built that year. Do we know how many are being built now? People are complaining about all the new construction in some areas.
Yeah, it's hard to walk around the city and not feel like you're in the middle of a construction zone. Again, the de Blasio target is 200,000 affordable units in 10 years. I'm not sure what the cumulative number of units is that's currently under construction, but certainly we're at some kind of high point.
At the same time, we seem to be at an architectural low point. Mm-hmm. These buildings are often quite unattractive.
Yeah, so this goes back to your earlier point about the nature of the construction. In some cases, it's about renovating an existing building, but in the farther reaches of Queens and Brooklyn, where it's more about purchasing an empty parking lot and putting up a new condo building, absolutely, a lot of these buildings leave much to be desired.
One of the big differences between 1929 and today is the vacancy rate then was 8%. Today, it's around 3.5% and just over 2% for rent-stabilized apartments. What does a vacancy rate like that tell us about the housing market?
It tells us, it speaks to the crisis. The real alarming fact is that concurrent with those stats that you just gave, roughly a third of New York City apartments are vacant 10 months out of the year. So you have a lot of absentee ownership. Again, you have a lot of land banking. I mean, think of 157. You know, a lot of people are upset with it because it cast a big shadow over Central Park. But a lot of those units are empty. A lot of it functions not as an apartment building, a condo building, but as a bank.
But didn't I also read that a lot of public housing units are empty these days?
Absolutely. And
aren't they supposed to fill the gap?
So there's a waiting list. It's in my book, but it's obscene, the waiting list for these units and the waiting list to get to repairs. There are several thousands of apartments that are awaiting repairs.
And there's no talk about building any more public housing. That has now been considered a failed experiment?
Exactly, particularly how we went about it through the Moses years and those sort of huge enclaves we created that were totally broken off from the rest of the city.
Now, there are liberals. Most economists think that that rent controls are a bad idea. The liberal economist Paul Krugman wrote, "The analysis of rent control is among the best understood issues in all of economics and among economists anyway, one of the least controversial. A ceiling on rents reduces the quality and quantity of housing." So not everybody thinks that rent control is a good idea. I'm talking about liberals.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The problem is I haven't heard a viable plan in its place. And until we find a way to measure this flow of global capital, we're going to eradicate the possibility of lower income and middle income New Yorkers staying in the city.
We also have these issues with politicians. In 2008, we learned that Democratic Congressman Charlie Rangel had 4 rent-stabilized apartments luxuriously renovated. Then Governor David Patterson also had a rent-stabilized apartment. What good does rent stabilization do if the apartments go to people who don't need them?
It's a very good question. Absolutely. It's poor leadership, and we certainly need better systems for deciding who we make these apartments available to.
And then City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito is a landlord with a townhouse in East Harlem, and she failed to disclose income from those tenants. Do we know what her position is on affordable housing?
I don't know. But again, this isn't ever going to be fixed until our leadership gets serious about fixing it. And that starts with their own lifestyle.
And then we have of the 51 council members, city council members, 35 owning property in New York City. How sensitive would they be to the circumstances of average New Yorkers?
It's a very good question. And I don't think, land ownership in itself is an inherent evil for a political leader or a public figure. I think it's actually probably an opportunity for them to show how they can be engaged in their community, how they can know their tenants, and make that a meaningful relationship.
A friend who's looking for a house now finds that there is this threshold. Everybody, all the owners who want to sell are thinking $1 million or more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where New York has come to. When you look at the rest of the country, people are shocked.
Yeah. And, we have the mansion tax, where if you sell a property at $1 million or more, you pay additional taxes. So if you look carefully at a lot of the transactions, a lot of them rest easy at that sort of 9999 space to avoid those extra taxes.
D.W. Gibson, who will be participating, a partner with WMYC in a multi-platform project looking in depth at issues of race, real estate, and gentrification in Brooklyn. You'll be hearing a lot more from him and the nation in partnership with the WMYC newsroom in the coming months. Thank you so much for coming on today to talk about your article, How to Dump Tenants and Make a Fortune.
Thanks for having me.